Hi, I'm Chickpea, and you're listening to Edition 67 of the Circle Day radio show on Resonance FM 104.4 in London, UK, and online at resonancefm.com. This is a special show where I speak with several members of the London Indie Media Collective. In case you are unfamiliar with indie media, I'll give you a very quick overview of what it is. A global participatory network and technical project founded 12 years ago as an alternative to government and corporate media. Historically, indie media has been closely aligned with the global justice movement and ever constant in its critique of neoliberalism, capitalist financial systems, and systems of hierarchy and oppression. Indie media, including Indie Media London, has existed as an explicit alternative to profit-driven media. London Indie Media, part of the aforementioned Indie Media Global Network, has been an excellent resource in recent years for organizing and information proliferation in the radical left of London. The individuals associated with London Indie Media have collectively racked up over 100 years of involvement in radical left political groups and have contributed to invaluable infrastructure that supported communication, opinion, and discussion in the wider left. The London Indie Media Collective recently issued a statement, available on their website at london.indiemedia.org, in regards to their decision to close down the project, stating a desire to move on to other political work. In the next half hour, you'll be hearing us discuss the reasons for moving on, reflecting on the past, and examining the current state of radical media and political organizing in an information age that is almost wholly taken up by a handful of corporately owned social media platforms. The full-length interview, along with a discussion with the radical movement publication Shift magazine, can be heard on Dissident Island Radio episode 111, which aired on 16th November 2012 and is available for download. You can find a link on the Circle Day Radio website at thecircleday.com or dissidentisland.org. And now, the discussion with London Indie Media. So let's go around the table and say hello, recognize our voices. I'm Chickpea.
Hi, I'm Maki.
I'm Isarian.
Hi, I'm Tony.
Hello, I'm Ricky.
And Bryn's not going to say hello.
Hello. Yeah.
Let's kick off with a question about producing radical media in the information age. So indie media, both the global phenomenon and, you know, people working within the London Indie Media Collective, the project started in a very different internet age, one where open publishing was far from the norm. And now it's one of the reasons why people connect to the internet to update their statuses, microblogging, posting pictures and links, you know, oftentimes on corporate-owned social networking sites. It's from the closing statement that is posted on London Indie Media. People have in their hands 3G mobile phones, collectively documenting minute by minute as events unfold. Self-publishing is the norm, but be careful what you wish for. We won, but we also lost. Corporate commodification of the self through social media platforms and the corresponding loss of privacy create considerable pitfalls alongside the huge opportunities. So leading on from that, how has the development of corporate social media affected indie media, and vice versa? Has indie media precipitated that?
Well, I think we could start off by thinking about what the media landscape was when we started the project. Many of us were doing this sort of thing in the late 90s, and at the time, it was more or less impossible, unless you had technical training, to actually get yourself onto the internet. So that the targets that we had in terms of the political intervention that we're making were a lot different than they are today. So at the time, if you had a demonstration or you, I don't know, you're pissed off in some way, you went out and did something, if the major network news providers didn't want to put you on the TV or the newspaper wanted to ignore you, they could do that and you were wiped from history. You didn't have a recourse, basically. So a lot of campaigns had to structure themselves in a way that they could get their soundbite, and everything was just structured around getting that soundbite. And that led to a really messed up way of conceptualizing what people were doing, and in some ways a very messed up set of activities. And the more radical segments especially, who would say things like, oh, we should socialize the means of production, things like that. That was impossible to get onto network TV, and it wouldn't have even made sense actually for people to hear that for 10 seconds or something like that. So that was the kind of political context in which we were operating. So suddenly we had access to technologies which would allow to a potentially global audience us to get on this new thing, the internet, and actually say what we wanted to say, unmediated, unconstrained by all of that. And it was very liberating at the time. So the whole landscape has now changed. And in fact, all of the targets that we had at the time, so the major agenda setting media, the TV news, print media, newspapers, all of that, they're actually being progressively wiped off the board by all of these new technologies that we were among the first to pioneer. So it's, in a way, as you said earlier, we kind of were among the first people to do that, to take that step and allow anybody on the in the world to just show up at a website, upload what they wanted to say and say it to the world. We're very undercapitalized. So I myself spent in the last 5 years, let's say, probably 3,000 hours coding stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was very tough for me by myself to beat corporations that have, millions in venture capital funding. And it just became progressively, harder and harder to try to keep up with things. So that's my own experience of things, is that that's one of the reasons that contributed to me, I guess, feeling, we just can't keep doing the same thing and expect to succeed. So we need to, take a break, stop, mm-hmm. think about what we're doing and figure out how to proceed next.
But I think there was also an explosion of people at the start of Indie Media that were interested in putting their skills to a new use. A lot of the tech people that really set up the infrastructure behind Indie Media, that came from a lot of hard work that actually suddenly they all started to link together and managed to build this massive network. And that's quite interesting. That's one thing I don't see around so much now, whether all those people are... I mean, you certainly see with Indie Media, maybe that it's not interesting people to work on anymore, so therefore they're finding new places to invent things, move forward, but it's certainly not the back room of Indie Media anymore. So as that wasn't going to develop, in some ways other things have got to take its place.
Is that perhaps one of the kind of negative aspects of the fact that there's been an explosion in all the different ways that people can communicate stuff out there? When Indie Media started up, as you say, with that landscape, it was a brilliant place that a lot of people involved in the radical movement and in technology focused on, because mm-hmm. it was the only thing like it. But now, of course, there are so many ways to get messages out, to get information out, that perhaps people have kind of become a bit more disparate because of that, which mm-hmm. is an odd effect, but I think that's kind of what's happened.
I think probably it's also to do with the fact that how the movement has developed into some kind of a fragmented... We didn't come out as a kind of a service for the movement. We came out as an intrinsic part of the movement. We were involved, that movement that was called like anti-globalization movement or whatever you want to call it, the movement of the... from Seattle, or even before, like in this country, from June 18, and you can go back to the G8 protest in Birmingham and all that. That was a movement that was coming together very strongly all over the globe. And for us, doing Indie Media wasn't all let's be cool techies trying to play with new things, which we kind of did, play with the internet in a new way, but it was an intrinsic part of that struggle of that movement. So for us, was a way of being active, is a way of direct action, which manifested itself in something that the movement didn't have, which was a voice, being able to actually speak for itself. That movement kind of lasted 5 years or 6 years, maybe, in its height, all the way until maybe the anti-war, 2003, 2004. And then it started to fragment, and the media suffered from that, from the fact that the energy at the beginning, that the way that everything was possible then, and that you could actually do things and anything that you wanted to do was possible, and you just put the skills together, knowledge together, and share resources and share everything you had, that kind of started to dissipate. And I think the media suffered from that, not only in London and the UK in general, but like all over the network.
But also one of the interesting things at that early stage was this belief that you could create an autonomous space where things, experiments could happen. And that, I'm coming not from a tech background. I've never really been involved in the tech side of Indie Media. I came from a print background and publications, eager to get political voices out further and further. And here was an opportunity that came up where we could suddenly talk to quite a lot of people and we could really get our numbers. People are reading the site up to millions, which at certain points, certain days, maybe not all the time. Mm-hmm. But and that was amazing for an alternative media voice to be getting out that far. And so But that was built on an experimental space where we didn't quite know what we were doing to start with. We were, let's try this, let's try that, let's do a radio station, let's do a print media, let's do some film screenings, let's improve the website. All these things were growing.
So it was totally about building autonomy and building resources and infrastructure for that movement. Then you need to have a movement in order to have for the infrastructure to be useful. If you don't have a movement, then the infrastructure kind of... you cannot maintain a physical social center if nobody's going to go, or if there is no movement behind it, sort of thing.
So are you blaming the lack of involvement from, the people, as in that's the downfall of Indymedia because no one's using it, or...?
Well, I think for a few years, people was using it. That was the major social center in the internet.
You're talking specifically about Indymedia globally or London Indymedia?
Well, yeah, both. In the UK, there was no other place where you could do that, and then in London, there was no other place. So that was it. But if the backbone of what you are part of kind of starts to dissipate, then you find that maybe it's not that useful or needed to have a platform like that. This bit of infrastructure is only useful if people take it as its own infrastructure and maintain it and take responsibility for it in terms of participating and whatever you need to do with any kind of autonomous bit of a structure for your movement.
I mean, when Mackie's talking about it, in a way, you've always compared our project to being kind of like a social center on the internet, like you just said. But it's a social center that we didn't close for 12 years. That has a certain pain to it. It's a social center that anybody can walk into 24 hours a day that you have some pride in, and you want to keep it clean and nice for people and useful to the people that you're working for, in a sense. But it never closes, and that takes its own special kind of toll and special kind of pain as well. So I think we're all a bit tired as well, maybe, in that sense.
I mean, 12 years is a lot of time.
Yeah, it's probably the longest project we'll ever be involved with for our whole lives, actually.
People in the London Collective all have a very interesting international experience as well. And as the closing article states, racked up over 100 years of activity in radical media and publishing. Let's talk a bit more about the closing down of Indymedia and potentially reflecting on the past as well. Basically, there seems to be an echoing of people saying that it's become irrelevant to a certain degree. And because it's become irrelevant, it's become too much of a project to maintain. And there's a need to close it down and move on, which is a really brave thing to do, not to hold on to something just because you can, but to realize something needs to come to an end and evolve the project, or personally or collectively. What kinds of lessons do you want to draw from the overall project in terms of being involved in Indymedia for so long, both on a global level and also creating a website and going through many phases of development as well, and seeing it sort of peter out?
I just want to go back to the closing. It wasn't that there's no one wants to use it. It's more that people are posting their stuff elsewhere, or not even posting their stuff. I mean, the main point of Indymedia was people reporting stuff for themselves, not relying on us being editors to put out what we thought of an action we've just been on or something. And so it was really the public trying to, activists doing it, or the public commenting on it. And that's what we felt was less and less. And that's probably what was going out to Twitter, going out to blogs, going out to wherever on the internet, going out to YouTube. A few people were still strongly going to demonstrations, feeling they had something to say, coming back and writing really good reports. And that's what we relied on. Mm-hmm. And that's what we had at the start, loads of people doing that. And then slowly it was getting down to less and less people. You know, some really good ones still hanging in there, doing some really good stuff. But we didn't feel it was for us to keep filling the gaps, plugging the holes, because really that wasn't what we were about. That wasn't why we'd set this structure up. We could have carried on almost as our own editorial collective and said, right, forget everyone else. We've got lots to say, and we have got a lot to say, and which we were doing elsewhere, but we were in some ways trying to still keep this open space, but people weren't using it anymore, so got to move on.
Do you feel that people weren't using it because less people are doing that, or because people have moved to other forms?
I think that people making their own media is now less of a conscious activity and almost just a byproduct of breathing or eating or something like that. It's just something they do all the time. Mm-hmm. And the platform that we had wasn't set up to do that. So, if somebody goes to a party tonight in London, they'll probably take 15 pictures of it, of their friends. They'll put that on Facebook. They'll tag all the, here's my friend Sammy, whatever. And that's just like a byproduct of their human activity almost, which is There's a lot of problems with that, but there's some things about it that are in some ways quite hopeful, and that's also interesting as well, because they do see it now as a almost that they have a right to express themselves on the internet in a way. And I think certainly you would see a lot of people being really pissed off in the developed countries if somebody just said, we're going to shut Facebook down because it's, you know, there's a big political upsurge on Facebook, for instance. That would actually be a major social battle that would suddenly be fought. It would be fought in a way that I don't know what it would look like. One interesting thing is, if you talk about what is the potential of these new reforms, the corporate-owned forms of media, and you say, well, could there ever be a revolution that was attached to them? We can say, well, yeah, there actually has been several, actually, already in the last 2 years. So Twitter and Facebook, people have various kind of feelings about how important they were, but they were to some degree important in what happened in the Arab Spring, for instance. The one thing that the kind of cheerleaders of this, I think, make a mistake in their thinking about is that Egypt is not the United States and Syria is not the United Kingdom. And to me, it's inconceivable that a revolution in the core countries of Western capitalism would not be met by the same kinds of police state tactics which the Egyptian government attempted to use but was incapable of doing because the servers were all located in the United States. So that's a major problematic thing about this kind of activity. And that's something that I think is being lost as people move away from self-organized radical publishing platforms.
Hi, you're listening to the Circle Day radio show on Resonance FM 104.4 in London, UK, and online at resonancefm.com. We're about halfway through an edited version of a discussion that aired on Dissident Island Radio episode 111, where we spoke to the ex-London Indie Media Collective, providers of invaluable radical movement infrastructure and news, about their reasons for shutting down their website and the current state of media production. And now let's get back to the program.
Yeah, I suppose that's one of the things that's been lost, the conversation and the argument about privacy and about understanding data retention. And indie media started at a time when there were, in the United States, what, three major television networks. And I mean, we still exist in an age where there is monopolized control of corporate media, but that corporate media, especially papers and television, is losing out increasingly, especially with the younger generation, to these new social networking platforms in terms of where people are getting their information and news. And so it's sort of like there's a new generation of people coming along which have a different relationship to information. But at the same time, there seems to be a lack of understanding of where that information is being kept and how controlled it is as well. In terms of things like social networking tools, there seems to be a fragmentation that's happening not only in the social movements, social justice movements, but also just across all spectrums of society as people become increasingly specialized in terms of what they want to look at and see in their feeds on Facebook and Twitter and who their friends are. In terms of corporate social media, can anything meaningful and sustainable, more importantly, because right now it seems like so much of the activity on social networking is so unsustainable in terms of, like, you just have to constantly be plugged in and everything, but can there be meaningful, high-level, sustainable political communication and engagement on these tools? Or is then one of the next battles to find another way to communicate between ourselves and move on?
Can I answer that? No.
We all know you hate Facebook.
No, I would say the other way. I hate Facebook actually. And Twitter. Yeah. I don't use it, but I think it's possible. It's just that people are too lazy to do it, or it just doesn't happen. I mean, I know for one example, you know, Ricky's reports on indie media that he would put on, these long stories that really told you what happened during the day. And then the difference between your Twitters, your tweets, whatever you call them. You know, I mean, a lot of people just do the tweets and say that's it, but Ricky would do the tweets and then follow up with a story, which mm-hmm. which would archive the day in that way. And that's the difference. The tweets themselves don't say much. They're exciting. They say, oh, something's happening there, or a general idea, but it doesn't tell you enough, especially mm-hmm. 2 or 3 days later when it's all disappeared.
So. Yeah, that's true, but it's also the fact that we need to recognize that they are very powerful tools for mobilizing. I mean, I think probably you see that more like in Southern Europe now, how almost everything that's going on in the squares and all the stuff we've been seeing lately, and And even the general strike this week and stuff, a lot of it has been kind of spread and organized through corporate media. And it's true, I mean, it's not that anything can happen. Something is happening, and a lot is already happening. The problem is that it is happening for as long as these corporations allow it to happen. And these corporations, for whatever reasons, want to pull the plug, or they are forced by the states or whatever, all this will fall, will just disappear. Which then will get into a complete void because, as Tony just said, all this noise, all this information that now is on Twitter or is on Facebook and stuff, it kind of gets buried straight away. There is no context. There is, you can't even look at something recent, the student movement, that's one of the most interesting things that happened, you know, in this country and a half ago, whatever, that even the riots of last year and stuff, go back and try to see, you know, and get information what happened only a year ago in Twitter or Facebook, and you just won't find it. The tool is very immediate, and it works very well for now, just for the minute, and for organizing, and to call for something for next week, but 3 weeks later, it's gone. Mm. In cyberspace, it's somewhere. That's something that in the media really was providing, was a context, because apart from the reports that were coming in before that, they would have generally been a piece, you know, explaining what the mobilization was about, background information about it, what the issues were, you know, the, contextualizing the thing, as well as archiving. You know, there is no other archive on the internet as in the media is, if you want to look at the last 10 years, 12 years of struggles, and especially from the radical perspective, you won't find it anywhere else. I mean, you still need to go to Indy Media and check the archives, and you can go back all the way to May Day 2000 in the UK and to Seattle in the States. You know, that is gone, and I think that's a big problem. What's going to happen when the corporations decide to stop this? Well, we don't know. I mean,
another side of that is not so much that they're going to switch it off one day. It's what's happening now behind the scenes, the filtering of information, because there's quite... I mean, I'm not up there to know what technically is happening in Google's language software behind the scenes, but there is filtering going on to make it easier to make it work, and they're starting to take away, well, this person's talking to lefty people, so he doesn't need to hear any other voices, and they start taking it out of your feeds. And you know, there's stuff happening there. It's not sinister. It's not sort of someone sitting there saying, right, we're going to stop these lot talking leftish stuff, but it's starting to change how we receive information, that I think is starting to focus us down to a tiny little ghettos everywhere. And that's not just us in the activist ghetto, it's also anyone else outside isn't hearing any politics anymore. If you don't profess a liking for that, you're never going to hear anything that's happening around the world anymore.
That was always a central tension in what we did, though, as well. I mean, it's not... Google does it through programming, but we did it all the time through moderation and through... It was very difficult for us to navigate that kind of desire on the one hand for open expression, which we do have, and on the other hand, to maintain a useful information resource for people. There were all kinds of different moments where people got pissed off about different things. Oh, this poem about a whale shouldn't be in the newswire, and that would have like a, you know, there'd be a big fight about that. And so, you know, there's nothing perfect in the world that you can ever make necessarily, but it is the case that at least with us, there was some kind of democratic input into what those decisions were, which has now been lost as well.
And there is a danger, I think, with Twitter, that you get a kind of crowd mentality as well. There isn't the room for analysis, and with Facebook. If an idea takes hold, suddenly lots of people start doing it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always a good idea, you know. And I think that having a place where people can look at some sort of analysis and some kind of history is really, really important to put those things in context. That crowd mentality, I mean, there's questions over some of the aspects of both the Egyptian and the Syrian situations that, you know, there's manipulation going on, there's Western governments planting information, doing all sorts of stuff. So it's very easy to manipulate crowds in that forum without any kind of proper analysis going on.
I'm going to read a little bit of the Indy Media London closing statement that's on the website. With a, you know, very sincere voice, it is with a sad heart that we bring this latest chapter to an end. All of us wish to continue working in a similar terrain and view what comes next as a development from the work that's already been done. However, for us, this Indy Media project is, for many reasons, no longer one that we think is tactically useful to put our energy into. So my question is, what is tactically useful? What do you think is worth putting your energy into right now? What is the future for the collective? Is it going to stay together? That's actually 5 or 6 or 10 questions. But feel free to address any one or all of them.
I think the collective will stay together. Everybody still loves working together after 10 years is quite amazing, actually. So
yeah, most longer than most marriages.
That's quite amazing. Yeah. After all, it's like there is still a kind of a willingness to to even see each other in the pub, have a few drinks. Yeah. Yeah. It's quite good.
Some kind of victory.
As a collective, I don't think we know. Well, we do have some ideas. Nothing is concrete. I mean, we only closed, what, a month ago? So after so long, it's a bit of a...
Time for reflection.
Reflection time and chill and enjoy the internet in a different way, not having to, like, continuously be monitoring what other people do. I think the idea of collective approach to media making is still very much part of what we would want to move, as opposed to my individual identity I can have in all this corporate media. Basically, it's a collection of thousands of individuals talking from a very personal and individualistic approach, which, when it comes all together, it gives an idea of the totality, but comes from a very individual perspectives and kind of self representation. We are, I think, interested still in participatory media, in collective processes and approaches, but it will definitely be something much smaller in terms of process than what in the media has been. I think we probably a bit tired of big mega processes. It would probably be a combination, well, I'm talking personally, what I would like to see is something that is a combination of much more editorial kind of approach to media making, but keeping some sort of open way of contributing. I think a lot of us, we have already started to produce more media rather than maintain a media project, like producing films, producing designs, producing code, producing stuff. I'm pretty sure something will come out of this.
And it's worth saying, I think, that just because Indie Media London has closed, there are lots of other indie medias in the world that continue to function. So just like to say hello to our friends in Brazil and our friends in Germany and in the Netherlands and the United States.
Germany is actually closing.
Yeah. You know, well, there are still people doing it. And,
yeah.
And go for it, guys, because
you know,
that's great.
You know. For our listeners' sake, what happens when you go onto the page?
Right now, the site is archived, so it's not possible to publish there anymore, but the history of the years that we put in is still there, and you can still see it, but you can no longer go there and participate.
Through the worst of times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you're down pairing your baby. What's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war. I call it co-conspirators.
Thanks for listening to the Circle Day radio show on Resonance FM 104.4 in London, UK, and online at resonancefm.com. You were listening to an edited version of a discussion that aired on Dissident Island Radio, episode 111, where we spoke to the ex-London Indie Media Collective, providers of invaluable radical movement infrastructure and news, about their reasons for shutting down their website and the current state of media production in an information age that is almost wholly taken up by a handful of corporately owned social media platforms. A full version of the interview, along with a discussion with the editors of Shift Magazine, a radical movement publication, can be found online via the Circled A website at thecircledA.com or dissidentisland.org. And I'm Chickpea. That's it for this week. Tune in next week for some more Circled A radio.
Solidarity's a four-letter word, we're all hypocrites. But you're a patriot, you thought I was only joking. When I screamed, kill Whitey at the top of my lungs, at the cops in their cars and the men in their suits. No, I won't take your hand and marry the state. Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to...